ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Smoke from the Victorian bushfires is even visible from space as people pick over the pieces of what's been left by the blaze.
I walked away with what I'm wearing. Well, I won't tell a lie, I'm wearing somebody else's shirt at the moment. I had a pair of pants, my jocks, and CFA uniform.
And we head to the Keppel Islands off of Queensland to the world's first underwater observatory that was a star tourism attraction in the 80s and 90s. It was a most unusual workplace and was even visited by the late Queen Elizabeth.
Not very many people go overseas to work each day underwater by the name of Coral and return on the Great Barrier Reef. So it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for me.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. As bushfires continue to burn in Victoria, New South Wales border communities are rallying around people who've been evacuated from farms and towns in the fire zone. It's close to the heart for people in the Snowy Valleys region, which was devastated by fires in the 2019-2020 summer. Emily Doak has more.
People evacuated from fires in northeast Victoria have been making their way through the Snowy Valleys, some heading to evacuation centres in Wodonga, and others pitching tents and pulling up caravans to wait out the fires close to home. Kath Hill, her 90-year-old father, two kids and three dogs left the family farm at Corryong when an evacuation order came through last Friday.
Originally our plan was to evacuate into Corryong Township if need be. So we had our grab bags and things ready to go, but then the word came through that Corryong Township actually was being evacuated. So we had to pivot pretty quickly to a plan to come to Tumbarumba. It's just waiting. And if you're going to be anywhere, you might as well be in Tumbarumba. Honestly, the community's been wonderful. It's a town just like Corryong, but it is a genuinely lovely place. You know, we've got a little creek here for the dogs to splash in, and you know, they're letting us have our Maremma, Border Collie and Labrador here with us, which is really great. And the community has been fantastic. The ladies at the op shop wouldn't let us pay for anything when we needed to get some more supplies there on Saturday.
The Tumbarumba region was hit hard by bushfires in 2019-2020 and the community's mobilised to help its Victorian neighbours, with local service groups coming together to set up an unofficial donation hub providing supplies to evacuees at the Tumbarumba Sports Academy. Peter McCrillis from Red Cross says it's a good example of how communities can identify what's needed.
You know, very raw for a lot of people in the Tumbarumba community. You know, waking up with the smoke yesterday morning, and then just the word got out very quickly that, you know, there's a lot of evacuees kind of passing through here, and people in Tumbarumba acted very quickly to contribute a lot. Everything that you see here, all these items, all these groceries and toiletries and blankets and towels, this all kind of happened within a matter of hours Saturday morning, basically. It was it was amazing to watch.
The Country Women's Association was one of the groups involved, with four branches supplying volunteers like Tina Billing from Batlow.
A lot of them just really needed to talk. They're still in shock. They really are in shock, but so grateful for even a cup of tea. And to be able to go in and take what they need.
And do you feel a bit of, you know, empathy for those people having been with your community hit so hard during 2019-2020?
Yeah, I do. The smoke came through Batlow 2 days ago and I think it triggered a whole lot of, you know, emotion for a lot of people. So I also feel too, we've been overrun with people who want to donate.
Further south, the village of Cancoban would normally be teeming with tourists. But as local resident and Snowy Valley councillor Grant Hardwick explains, they've been replaced with firefighters and some evacuees.
When those who had rooms available have taken in people, even extra firefighters have come into the town. We've got the local businesses that are supporting that through either accommodation or providing on food and catering for those extra people that have come into town to either fight the fires or having left their properties. So Cancoban was a place for people to go, particularly those who wanted to remain close to home, but Other places like Tumbarumba and further afield where people have family and friends and people there also open up their arms to be that little bit further away and just be that little bit more safer.
Owner of the local caravan park, Tony Rowlandson, closed it for a few days last week when the weather conditions were severe.
The idea was that it would be more beneficial to not have tourists with caravans on the roads if we did have to evacuate in a hurry. Like last time in 19, it was quite fast in 19. So we took it on ourselves to close the park and ask the tourists to leave to take that little bit more off the road.
Now that conditions have eased, the caravan park's been reopened. But Tony is still on alert.
At the moment, we're safe, but things can change at a drop of a hat. And so just be ready if we need to be. Have a plan and look after yourself. You know, buildings and that can be replaced, but you need to look after your life and yourself, your pets, that sort of stuff.
Tony Rowlandson from the Cancobbin Lakeside Caravan Park, and he was speaking there to Emily Doak and Melinda Hayter.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
Stories are pouring in from the fire front in Victoria as people pick over the pieces of what's been left behind by the blaze. The ABC's news channel were in Longwood East this morning, and Nate Byrne and Emma Ribellato spoke to resident and cattle farmer Theo Lagarde, who lost his home.
Well, I was actually on the fire ground over at Tarkham because the blaze was heading that way and houses were being impacted. The guys had been on the ground for a fair few hours and I was back at the shed here, so we put the barbecue on, cooked some sausages, grabbed a loaf of bread and threw it in the car. We'd take it up there. And while I was up there, they radioed in to say there's going to be a wind change. And I said to the guy that was with me, we better get back to the shed. Came back to the shed, said to the guys at the shed, I'm just going to duck home if it's coming this way to set up at home. So I just live on the Wybie track. I met my daughter halfway down the track and come back and we'll let the cows out and it's heading this way. And so when we got home, she went around and let the cows out and I went and shut all the doors for the sheds. And so we'll go down to the house and grab all the gear that we need to keep, sort of thing. But by the time I got to the house, it was too late. It was chasing us. It had come over the rise and through the Wybie track and I could see the blaze about, I don't know how high, but they were bloody high. And so I said to Kel, just get out. Well, we had to basically go out the back way, cut the fence out the back and go out the back gate because we couldn't get back down the Wybie track. And the heat was so intense. In my shed, I had so much stuff, but there's nothing, there's not even anything to show that the stuff was there. It's just disappeared as if it's vanished. Wow. I had containers with tyres in it, completely sealed closed for the Land Cruiser that I bought. And I thought, oh, well, that'll be all right. And open up, no, there's nothing left. It's gone. As if somebody's taken it away before the fire. It was, I just can't believe how everything's just steel cages, the dog kennels, gone. There's no evidence that were ever there. Mm. So you can imagine how hot that thing was and how fast it was travelling. Because when we left Tarkham, the fire hadn't got this far, but it was outrunning us to get here, obviously.
That's incredible. Do you have anything left?
I walked away with basically what I'm wearing. Well, no, I tell a lie. I'm wearing somebody else's shirt at the moment. I had a pair of pants, my jocks, and CFA uniform.
And that's it?
That and my wife and my two dogs. That's all they got out. I didn't have a chance to go and get my wallet or anything because I didn't have the wallet in the fire ground because I didn't want to lose it. So all cards and identification, everything, the sort of pack that we had prepared to evacuate, I just, because we were so far away when they changed it, when the wind changed. And the wind changed so many times that day, it was impossible to fight it because we were at the head of the fire and then the wind would change and it throws sparks out another way. And by the time the trucks got there, it's already spread again. We just didn't have enough trucks or cars or helicopters. And you look, it wouldn't have mattered how many trucks you had here.
No.
It wouldn't have. It might have saved a few more homes, but it wouldn't have changed the outcome.
Longwood East farmer Theo Lagarde there. 2 hours' drive away, the Mount Alexander transmission site in central Victoria has been significantly damaged by fire and remains off air. The site normally provides radio and TV services to communities around Bendigo, Castlemaine and all the nearby towns. BAI Communications Operations Manager Chris Howe spoke to our reporter Daniel Miles.
The fires that burnt through the Harcourt area on Friday night also burnt up the Mount Alexander, and they did damage to the transmission sites that are up there. And the transmission sites are the are responsible for delivering both FM and DTV services or digital television services to the Bendigo and surrounding regions.
So how did the fire damage the site? Is it to an actual tower itself, or is it power supply?
The majority of the damage is to the power supplies and to the antenna systems, and there were some transmitters damaged for television services.
Okay. Do you have any idea when things are going to return to normal?
Yeah, we don't have an idea of when anything will return to normal yet. We are assessing. I'm actually heading to Bendigo myself tomorrow, and an engineering team is on their way there now. To assess the damage. So the process will be first figuring out what we have that is usable. Obviously, we've got photos and information to tell us what was damaged, but we've got to figure out what's usable. We've got to then bring in the bits and pieces of equipment that will allow us to get services back to air temporarily. So we'll be focusing on temporary service recoveries in the short term. And then there's a much longer engineering project or program to return the site to full capacity and full capability.
Is there a rough timeline as far as days, weeks, months, just to give us a bit of a rough understanding of the scope of what needs to happen here?
In terms of services returning, it will depend on where people are. So people in the Bendigo City area, once we get temporary services operating, they will probably see services in a faster time frame. People that are around the, you know, Echuca or further afield outside of Bendigo, they might still have some impacts ongoing for quite a while. We're not talking about services returning in days, that's for certain. It's a very significant loss, this one, to lose antenna systems and to lose power systems. I mean, those are the two things that you really need alongside transmitters to get these services running.
Chris Howe speaking to Daniel Miles about the damage to the Mount Alexander transmission site in central Victoria, which is now knocked off air, and they're working towards fixing it. You're listening to Australia Wide with me, Sinead Mangan. Now, cane toads have marched their way across much of northern Australia since they were introduced to the country 80 years ago. What might seem like a lost cause to some is driving one tropical island community in Queensland to double their efforts to eliminate them. That's after they've raced them at the pub. Reporter Megan Dancy has this story from Magnetic Island.
For more than 50 years, tourists and locals have gathered out the back of a pub on Magnetic Island. It's a race with a difference. Bids are taken from around a circular arena as onlookers look to back the fastest cane toad on the day.
There he is. Did you win? How about that?
Toad handler Paul Gilligan says the races are a novel way for people to interact with the species, one of Australia's most hated invaders.
Once all eight toads are in the starting contraption there, we lift them up, and it is the first toad to completely cross that white line is the winner. It's just something so unique that you don't see anywhere else.
The island has plenty of healthy racing stock to choose from. Magnetic Island sits just 8 kilometres from the mainland, and cane toads can be found in public parks, waterways and national park areas. One group of dedicated locals, the Maggie Toadbusters, is taking a different approach to dealing with the toad population. Peter Illich helps run the group. He says they're on a mission to eliminate the island's toad population over the next 3 years.
We've got a bunch of toad busters out there. So the community, and the community's been doing this for a long time, but we're sort of bringing everybody together.
The group's eradication efforts, helped by a grant of over $16,000 from the Queensland Government's Gambling Community Benefit Fund.
We will definitely reduce their numbers to a point where, you know, they're not making such a big impact on our wildlife. And it would be really nice to see no toads on the island, and that's a dream.
It's a familiar story across northern Australia. Cane toads have marched to far-flung corners of the country since they were introduced to the cane fields of North Queensland in the 1930s, a biological control experiment turned invasive species failure.
They have gone right across the top end of the Northern Territory and into northern Western Australia.
Professor Ross Alford from James Cook University says tropical islands like Magnetic Island have been no exception, with toads easily transported in cargo.
Most likely the toads got there just by hitchhiking a ride, because there's so much vehicle traffic by ferries, because they climb into vehicles. If people are taking pallets of things over there, they will climb in between the layers of pallets.
On Magnetic Island, the Maggie Toadbusters hope to interrupt the life cycle early, laying 30 funnel-like traps in waterways to capture as many tadpoles as possible. Toadbuster Bruce Hobby has been in the creek every day and parks golf courses and public common areas every night, scouring the landscape for toads.
It's important always to wear gloves when you're doing that, because they do have poisonous glands, and they can be, you know, bigger than your thumb, these glands, and they ooze out this white sticky poison.
So far, the group has hauled in 80 kilos of tadpoles and about 480 adult toads, humanely euthanized in keeping with federal department standards.
Australia's wildlife is so unique and so special, and to seeing it being affected by basically an invader to our country, It's sad to see.
It's no small task ahead for the group, with estimates putting Australia's cane toad population at more than 200 million. Peter Illich says it's a fight the Maggie Toadbusters are willing to take up.
By the third year, we hope that we can look at it again and go, well, you know what, if we keep doing this, we've got the gear, if we keep doing this, maybe we could get rid of it completely off the island.
They're a determined bunch, the Maggie Toadbusters. Megan Dancy with that story from Magnetic Island. Out from the crystal clear beaches of Great Keppel Island in sunny central Queensland lies an unusual abandoned structure. The Middle Island Underwater Observatory was the largest of its kind in Australia when it opened in 1980 and was visited by hundreds of people each day. The future of the site, that closed in 2008, now lies in the hands of the state government, who rescinded the leases from former Great Keppel Island resort owners Tower Holdings in 2023. While waiting for news on its fate, observatory gift shop worker Coral Wedd shared her memories of her time underwater with Vanessa Jarrett.
When Coral Wedd's parents named her, little did they know it would end up being quite a fitting name.
The owner of the observatory lived two doors down from where I lived in Yeppoon. As a neighbour, when he was building the observatory, he said, with a name like Coral, you must come and work on the observatory with me.
So she did. In the 1980s and 90s, the Middle Island Underwater Observatory was a star attraction in the crystal clear waters around the Keppel Bay Islands, off the coast of Yeppoon, on Queensland's Capricorn Coast. It was the brainchild of Jim Nimmo, and at the time was the largest in Australia, opening on September 25, 1980, with much fanfare.
Lots of broadcasting, radio and TV broadcasting. Very important people coming across.
It was around the time Great Keppel Island, known by most as GKI, was booming in its heyday.
There were hundreds of tourists would come down, busloads of tourists would come down daily from Rockhampton to the Capricorn Coast. They would load on to the tourist boats. We would have three or four times a day, we'd have probably 200 people into the observatory.
These days, the only visitors are marine life and scuba divers or snorkelers. The future of the site now lies in the hands of the state government, who rescinded the leases from former Great Keppel Island resort owners Tower Holdings in 2023. Mid last year, a tender was awarded to a demolition company to clean up abandoned buildings on Great Keppel Island. a Department of Natural Resources and Mines, Manufacturing and Regional and Rural Development spokesperson, said the condition of the underwater observatory is still under assessment. The structure itself was unique. It was designed that an electrical current would pass through it 24 hours a day to prevent corrosion, and 500 tons of ballast loaded through a giant funnel and crane at Roslyn Bay Harbour. Once it was completed, it was towed by a line of boats to sea and set down 6 metres below sea level on plated piles driven into the seabed.
The windows of the observatory were the only ones of its kind. They were 6 foot long, not the little portholes that most of the observatories had at the time.
2 weeks after the opening, there was another big event, a wedding.
A wonderful couple, quite a novelty for the underwater observatory. Young couple decided to get married there. The reception, of course, was held on Great Keppel Island, but the actual ceremony was first one, and as far as I know, the only one of its kind held underwater.
The observatory hosted other major life events too.
We also had the very sad episode of planting a chappie's ashes. We received a letter at one stage. A young fellow that had visited the underwater observatory and had been fascinated with the setup and the fish, the Great Barrier Reef, he went home to New South Wales, and through an unfortunate accident, he died. His parents contacted the observatory and said that they would like to bury his ashes outside in the water. A diver from the observatory took the ashes. The parents stood and watched as he planted the ashes under a rock and in the sand. It was a bittersweet day for his parents, but that was a first too for the observatory.
While the underwater observatory's future remains unclear, Coral Wed says it will always hold special memories.
It was a wonderful time working on the observatory. It was an unusual time. Not very many people go overseas to work each day underwater by the name of Coral and return on the Great Barrier Reef. So it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for me.
Sure was. Coral Wed speaking with Vanessa Jarrett about her time working at Middle Island Underwater Observatory near Great Keppel Island in the 1980s. To wave or not to wave, that is the question for Aussie drivers. It's a well-known tradition. For decades, a friendly gesture between two strangers driving at high speed in the middle of nowhere in opposite directions was once common on Australian highways. Is that still the case, though? Jeremy Jones has taken a look in Rockhampton.
As a nation of travellers, we're familiar with road rules. But what about those unwritten laws of driving in Australia? Like, when is a wave appropriate? Or how mandatory is it to raise an index finger, the classic outback salute, as you drive past someone on the highway? I took to the streets of Rockhampton to find out what the rules of the wave are and how to be a friendly driver in 2026.
I do wave at people, but I don't. I wave more out in the country than I do in town, I must admit.
Anywhere where I'm 10Ks out of a city or town, everyone loves it. Yeah, got to give it to them. And if they give it to you, you got to give it back otherwise. Yeah, it's just rude.
I think as soon as you get west of Emerald, you've got to do it mandatory. But if someone flashes you, you've got to do it. And if you flash someone and they don't do it, geez, I get offended if they don't give it back.
I do it when someone flashes their lights at me because, you know, half the time I need it.
I think if someone lets you in, you've got to salute. And if they let you in, you give them a nice little salute first. But it's mandatory.
Usually when you're heading towards roundabouts... But not a lot of times, only in my local area.
Do you get many waves back?
50-50. And the older generation, not the younger kids. I think they think we're a bit strange if we give them a wave.
When do you do the finger salute?
I do it to any, like, where there's, like, workers at roadworks and stuff. If I'm at a stop sign and then, you know, roadworks. And then also if I'm in, like, the middle of nowhere and I've seen a car for the first time in, like, 30 minutes, then I'll give a finger salute, so, yeah.
Truck driver and road safety advocate Rod Hanafy says he noticed a decline in the people who waved to truckies, and he reckons, as a nation of mateship, a little wave can help keep our friendly culture alive. It's one of the reasons there's now a campaign to create a national Wave to a Truckie Day. Until then, we might just have to take it on ourselves to share the love.
Whenever someone gives away to me, you got to chuck it up. It's mandatory, as they said, but, you know, if you just feel like being friendly... Just give anyone a wave on the crosswalk. Go about your day.
Sometimes
your indicator of something or something happens on the road and you're like, oh, yep, and you just give them a bit of a flick, so...
Well, I wave at cars when I'm crossing the street when it's not a pedestrian crossing, when they let you cross. So not everyone does it, but the ones that do always get away. And driving the same when you indicate and they actually let you in, which is rare in Rockhampton. But, give them a bit of a thank you.
I'm pretty easy to please. Just if anyone smiles at me, I'll just wave at them. But just overall kindness, you know, spread it.
Not a bad motto, that one. Spread kindness. Drivers in Rockhampton speaking to Jeremy Jones. And that is Australia-wide for this Tuesday. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.